We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, glad things finally thawed out so you could get here.
It was a struggle. I actually had to park my car and walk part of the way this morning because of all the snow and
That was a few days ago. No, actually, the difference in snow response this time was much better than the last time, 2 years ago, with a couple of exceptions. And one of those exceptions was Monday night, the Monday night commute. And it just is beyond me why the State Department of Transportation chose not to open the express lanes northbound, which is typically
on I-5, which
is typically what they do for the evening commute anyway to get people out of the city and back home, is they open the express lanes northbound. Well, they didn't do that this time. They couldn't spare the two guys to run around and swing open the gates and switch the lights. They had those two guys out plowing roads and salting them. They couldn't spare a couple of people from the back room, you know, whoever answers the phone or whatever,
to go and do that. The rationale that they gave publicly was that they were concerned about icing on the ramps, which, you know, how hard is that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, send a snowplow out, do the ramps, open them up, get people home.
Snowplow?
You know? But I tell you, I mean, it wasn't just icing on the ramps to the express lanes. There was plenty of ice on the exit ramps from the main lanes of I-5. I mean, I experienced that in the U district on a bus. I got on a bus which got on the freeway, and it took 2 hours of stop and go traffic to get from downtown to the University District. And once we got there, we waited for almost half an hour to get off the dang freeway because a truck had jackknifed on the ramp. So, I mean, you're going to have those problems anywhere, but not opening the express lanes was a serious mistake. I mean, that made the evening commute on Monday worse than any commute of the 2008 snowstorm.
Yeah, although in 2008, they didn't plow arterials for days and days and days. And the switch to salt this time was an improvement. They got to arterials much faster. Mayor McGinn was out of town, so they probably didn't make sure to plow his road first. It was all in all a much better commute, but it's still, it invariably astonishes me how completely shut down the city can get over 2 inches of snow when you know that on average, once or twice, maybe three times every year, we're going to have frozen weather, and the city needs to be prepared and preparing its budget also for responding to that, and the same with the state DOT. And, you know, you hear people making the apology, well, hills, cities that have snow all the time don't have to worry about having hills. Well, that's nonsense. Anybody who's been to Pittsburgh or I don't know, Boston, remember what Beacon Hill, remember what that's named after?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are plenty of cities back east that have hills and snow and manage to cope just fine, and people drive around after 2 inches of snow like nothing has happened. Now, you wouldn't expect that level of preparedness here because, for one thing, we got a lot more people here who don't know how to drive in it and don't know how to get around in it, and that includes bus drivers, I might add.
Yes.
But nonetheless, granted it was also a holiday week, so that there was a lot of incentive for people to just not go into work for a couple of days. But there's just an amazing shutdown of the city over not really that much consequential frozen precipitation.
Yeah, and the other thing that bugged me about the snow response was, once again, the Metro bus system. Now, they got chains on the buses early on, which was a good thing. And they had buses running on a lot of the main streets, where there was very little snow, which was a good thing. A lot of the arterials that had been salted and taken care of by the DOT. But once again, you went to the Metro Transit website, and it was very difficult to get updated information on which buses, which routes were
running. It's very badly designed.
It's extremely poorly designed. You have to sign up for little alerts on your specific bus route, which is not acknowledging the fact that a lot of people choose not to drive and only take the bus in bad weather. So, you know, these people are not going to be getting regular alerts about their specific bus route. In addition, a lot of people...
They may not even know what their bus route is.
Yeah, in addition, a lot of people switch their bus routes when there's bad weather because they know that their bus route goes up a hill, so they walk a little distance to try out different bus routes, and they have no clue then where what the special alerts are going to be on those routes. So, you know, it would be great if Metro could get their website redesigned so that right there on the front page there's a blog or something where you can see what the updates are. Now, once you get on a bus, if the driver has the speaker on, you can hear the alerts that he's getting phoned into him from the main base, where it'll say, for example, you'll be sitting there on the bus and you'll hear them tell the driver, all Route 43s stay off of 23rd Avenue East, go up the Route 49 route. It'd be great if they would post that right on the front page of their website so that riders get the same information at about the same time.
Yeah. And all this was predicted days in advance.
People
actually had it right.
Yeah, it's not as if Metro hasn't had this problem in the past. They had the same problem in 2008.
Yeah. And again, getting information on canceled routes is very, very difficult. You know, none of the routes near my house were operating at all, and basically the only way to know that was to go to the bus stop and wait.
And wait for an hour, you know, and find out, well, they're not coming, my feet are frozen, I have to hike back home.
I always thought, you know, if they're going to do it so poorly, maybe the city could spend money on just having people go around and deliver us hot drinks at different locations, you know, at the different bus routes.
No, I mean, it would be easy. I mean, if a volunteer website like Eat the State can have a blog on the front page where we can easily post updates, why can't Metro Transit, for crying out loud?
Yeah. By the way, can you tell that nothing else happened locally this week?
Well, luckily things happen nationally and internationally.
Oh, yes.
Let's move on to national and some developments with hedge funds.
Yeah, the SEC released their rules this week on hedge funds. Now, they were required by the Dodd-Frank bill to issue new rules on regulating hedge funds. Their draft rules that they've announced would require hedge funds with over $150 million in investments to register with the SEC. They would have to disclose the amount of money they manage, the details about their firms and who their managers are, and the type of investors, like, for example, whether they have individuals versus corporations versus pension funds versus state pension funds, et cetera, as their investors. Also, they would have to name the other businesses that provide services to the hedge fund and any kinds of conflicts of interest. They would have to tell who their brokers are, their accountants, their auditors, which companies market their products, etc. However, there are some hedge funds that would be exempt from the full disclosure and registration rules. That's any hedge fund under $150 million in investment, any foreign-based funds that don't have offices in the U.S., and boy, there are plenty of those, and any funds that function only as venture capital funds. There's a specific definition for which funds would qualify as only venture capital funds, but that definition may change as hedge fund managers get to weigh in on the rules, because there's going to be about 45 days for the SEC to take comments on the new rules before they issue the final rules.
You can also bet that those 45 days are going to be used to set up subsidiary companies qualify under the new rules.
Yeah, or that would be exempt from the new rules, yeah. And this also comes at about the same time that the SEC is engaging in this big insider trading investigation of a couple of very large hedge funds. They're interested in trying to keep track of this. We'll see how well those insider trading rules or those conflict of interest rules survive in this new draft from the SEC.
All right. Anything else on that?
No. Let's move on.
All right. Well, speaking of money, there's some developments with money laundering this week.
Yeah. Tom DeLay, the former Speaker of the House, who was charged in 2002 with money laundering in the case of funneling corporate contributions to state house races in Texas in order to stack the Texas State House to change the districting of the from the 2000 census for the U.S. House of Representatives, which resulted in 2004 in the election of a whole bunch of new Republicans to the U.S. House of Representatives. He was finally convicted 8 years later of money laundering, and it was really a classic case of horses and barn doors and that sort of thing. Now, mind you, follow the chain here. Tom DeLay engages in political chicanery, which, as it turns out, was illegal under the law to funnel what were then illegal corporate campaign contributions, because under Texas state law, corporations could not contribute directly to political campaigns, in order to elect a bunch of people who changed the districting, thereby resulting in the election of more Republicans to Congress. Congress then verifies the nomination, approves the nomination of two extremely conservative Bush Supreme Court justices to the Supreme Court, Samuel Alito and John Roberts. Alito and Roberts are then the swing votes in the Citizens United decision, which allows corporate contributions and political campaigns. So now in 2010, thanks to the very crime for which Tom DeLay has just been convicted, that crime is no longer illegal. It's as though you committed a murder and then went out, and because you committed that murder, murder was no longer considered a crime. It's remarkable. And who says crime doesn't pay in this country? Now, DeLay himself may or may not face any jail time over this. The sentencing guidelines call for him to face 5 to 20 years in prison, but you can bet it's going to be on the very, very soft side of that, given that he is a very distinguished former member of Congress. But above and beyond that, the people that he was working with and for certainly faced no consequences off of his crimes, and in fact, they benefited mightily from it. And we saw the results of that just in this past midterm election, where the corporate money that resulted from this Citizens United decision elected a whole new generation of Republicans to the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yeah, and you know, in addition to that, you can see that whole dynamic at work again in these last elections, where these 501c4 groups, which are supposed to only spend about 50% of their donations on political causes, a lot of those 501c4 groups spent money, I'm fairly sure, in excess of 50%. And
98, 99.
Yeah.
Because that's the only reason that they were incorporated in the first place.
And to prosecute them, the IRS would have to audit them. Well, I'm guessing the Republicans who were just elected with all of that campaign money spent by 501c4 corporations are going to be looking at that whole rule about 50% only. Maybe we can change that law.
Yeah, and not only that, but guess who has oversight over the IRS?
Yeah.
Sweet. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay, let's jump to international then. And President Obama at the NATO summit.
At the NATO summit, yeah. We talked a little bit in the last couple of weeks about how President Obama has been telling the U.S. public that U.S. troops would be out of Afghanistan by July 2011, while at the same time Hillary Clinton and Defense Secretary Robert Gates and the Joint Chiefs of Staff have been going around saying, well, no, it's really 2014. We're going to be there till 2014. Well, lo and behold, Obama goes to the NATO summit this past week, and he sits down with the other members of NATO who have troops in Afghanistan, and he says, yep, that's exactly right, 2014. So yeah. Once again, this just shows who's really running our foreign policy. It's not Obama. It's Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And it's certainly not the large number of people who are outside the gates of that NATO summit protesting over the Afghan war.
That's right.
So one of the big questions will be is if the other NATO members agree to 2014, because they're in this as well to a degree.
Yeah, but not nearly to the same degree that we are.
Yeah, yes, definitely.
And those what's the term? Coalition partners. Those coalition partners are under extremely heavy both diplomatic and financial pressure to get with the program. Mm-hmm. That's in fact was a large part of what the agenda at the NATO meeting was all about.
Yeah, and it really kind of goes back to the original election of Obama. He really had to get Hillary Clinton on his side in order to campaign well again and have a good showing against John McCain. And I think to do that, he promised her one of the most powerful portfolios in the cabinet, which is our version of the foreign secretary. And she really has determined foreign policy to a large extent.
Well, and we didn't actually list it. I'm surprised we forgot about this. But there's going to be some documentation coming out on that here soon. I understand WikiLeaks is about to release a phenomenal amount of diplomatic, what do I want to say?
From the State
Communications
Department.
From State Department.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Going back 5 years here in next week or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and remember Hillary Clinton, her background on the Senate Armed Services Committee, she had the nickname of Madam Yes. She's extremely hawkish. That was one of the main policy differences between her and Obama in the 2008 primary season, was her hawkishness on foreign affairs. That is showing up in U.S. foreign policy now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on from there to developments in Ireland.
Yeah, this week Ireland finally accepted the bailout package proposed to them by the European Union. Ireland has been, right after Greece, has been the nation in the European Union that has been teetering the most on the verge of bankruptcy, with I think it's something like 32 to 36% of their debt being 32 or 36% of their gross domestic product, quite high by international standards. Now, they accepted a $114 billion aid package from the European Union in order to refinance their debt. However, the trade-off was that they had to agree to austerity measures. And those austerity measures included some pretty steep tax increases and cutbacks in social service programs. Now, what's very interesting is a lot of economists are saying, you know, taking money to bail out banks, to bail out the Irish government so that they can pay back these big international banks, and then forcing them to increase taxes and to make cuts in social service programs, that's going to harm the Irish economy, and it's going to make it even harder for them to pay back their debts. It's a vicious cycle. So why not just allow Ireland to default on at least some of its debt and force investors, the folks who bought those bonds, to take some loss on their investment, which is the way the system really is supposed to work.
Yeah, right now investors are taking no loss. The loss instead is being picked up by Irish taxpayers, and then Irish taxpayers are the ones being made to suffer because of the cutbacks in social services that are being forced by the austerity measures because of the government's bankruptcy.
Yeah, and unfortunately, even the very mention of the idea of allowing Ireland to default on just a portion of its debt then sent the cost of the interest on Irish bonds up to about 8.8%, made it extremely high and made it more expensive for Ireland to borrow money to refinance its debt. And it really goes to the problem of international investing now. The fact that government bonds are not held primarily by a nation's public anymore. It's not held by national banks, not held by the citizens of a nation anymore. It's held by international investors. So even the very whiff of investors having to take a little bit of loss can punish a nation's interest, can push a nation's interest rates way high. You get punished almost immediately because of the international nature of investing now.
Yeah. And the other problem that Ireland has run into is that they don't have their own currency anymore. They bought into the euro, so they don't have the tool available of devaluing their own currency so as to raise money
in order
that way
to make their debts a little more manageable. But it really points to a problem with the whole globalization of finance now. And now that the European Union is going down the road of bailout instead of default, it looks like Portugal's going to be next in line for a bailout, which the European Union can probably handle because Portugal's not a big economy. But right behind Portugal is Spain, whose economy is twice the size of Greece, Ireland, and Portugal's put together. And the European Union is going to be pretty strained if they have to do a bailout for Portugal and then do a bailout in addition for Spain.
So being tied into the euro, they just can't, like we can, we can just print more money.
No.
Well, and again, what the people who pay the price for this are not the people who pursued
exactly
these bubbles in the first place, and the investors who pursued these reckless policies and the banks that made these reckless loans. It's taxpayers and people who need to benefit by government and social services.
That's right.
All right. Anything else on that, or moving
nope,
on
let's
to
move on.
North and South Korea?
Yeah, this week North Korea did an artillery attack on the Yongpyeong Island that killed two soldiers and two civilians. Yongpyeong Island is part of South Korean territory. However, it's a garrison island, meaning that most of the population is South Korean Marines. not South Korean civilians. There are a few civilians in a small village there that got hit by artillery fire, but the main thrust of the artillery fire was against the Marine dugouts and the Marine installation on Yongpyeong. But it's helpful to put this attack into some context. South Korean President Lee Myung-bak is being blamed by a lot of the South Korean populace for the attack because President Lee, when he first was elected, decided that he would end all unconditional food aid to North Korea, basically putting the North Korean government in a bad position in trying to feed its population. North Korea has not been self-sufficient in food for decades. And ending unconditional food aid from South Korea was a huge step in isolating North Korea diplomatically. In addition, the U.S. has been pushing hard on China to clamp down on international sanctions against North Korea. China has been resisting, but the fact that the U.S. and South Korea have been pushing hard to not just isolate North Korea, but to starve North Korea is a big part of why this attack came about. In addition, summer...
And again, this goes back to President...
Way back to Bush.
Not President Bush. I was going to say Secretary of State Clinton and the hawkishness of American foreign policy under this.
She's carrying on the Bush foreign policy,
yeah.
In essence. This summer, President Obama decided to announce joint military exercises with the U.S. and South Korea in waters that China and North Korea consider to be part of their national waters, or at least part of their economic influence in those waters. And Obama didn't set a date for that, but as soon as the artillery attack happened on Yongpyeong Island, he came out and said, well, we're doing them this coming Sunday. So that's been his response, hasn't been to try to ease tensions, it's been to up the tension. So I just wanted to make that clear, since that hasn't been talked about very much in the U.S. press.
And I think another item of perspective is the fact that North and South Korea have had an armistice since the Korean War, and there's never was a peace negotiated, and the U.S. has been a key player in
keeping that from happening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And you may ask why, after 60 years, nearly 60 years since that armistice, the U.S. still has literally hundreds of thousands of troops on the South Korean peninsula.
You may ask
that. Or you may not. You may not care at all.
Right. Let's move on. Developments this week in Iraq.
Yeah, President Jalal Talabani nominated Nouri al-Maliki to be prime minister this Tuesday in Iraq, something that everybody could see coming from miles and miles away. Now, the cabinet positions have been also given special point values based on their budgets and their prestige. So now the negotiating is going to begin over who gets what cabinet positions, according to some arbitrary point values. I guess the ministries with the highest point values, the so-called sovereign ministries, include foreign affairs, finance, oil, defense, interior, which controls the police, et cetera, versus the lower point value ministries like health and agriculture and that sort of thing.
Ambassador to Brunei.
Yeah, Ayad Alawi, whose coalition won the election and who withdrew from parliament on the first day that parliament met a couple of weeks ago, and then who promptly fled back to London, has since Tuesday returned to Iraq to get involved in elbowing his way into some of those sovereign ministries. We'll see if that actually happens or not.
Yeah. By the way, there's a very good article in the New York Times this morning talking about how many of the people who have over the past year or two returned to Iraq to try and, you know, reclaim something of their lives after the subsiding of some of the sectarian violence that marred that country are turning around and leaving again because the economic conditions there are so bad, the lack of the formation of a government, the economy, and the continuing, we can't call it an occupation, we can't call it a war, presence of the United States military. There.
Yeah. 9 months of no central government in Iraq has literally made all public services pretty much break down. So it's bad when refugees who have been living hand to mouth in other countries return to Iraq and realize it is worse here than living in a camp somewhere else.
All right. Moving on to developments this week in Afghanistan.
Yeah, this week in Afghanistan, the results were announced from the September 18th elections, and promptly Hamid Karzai decided that he was going to arrest two members of the Electoral Complaints Commission, one member of the Independent Election Commission, and at least one UN employee, because, of course, he didn't like the results of the election. Well, that's true for just about everyone who was involved in the election, who was part of a political party that participated. Nearly everybody doesn't like the results because, as it turns out, nearly one quarter of all the votes nationwide were thrown out as fraudulent, and less than half the parliamentary incumbents were reelected.
And you would ask why Karzai didn't like the results, since he was personally responsible for so many of them.
Yeah, well, a lot of his candidates were not reelected. But in addition, still to be decided were the results in Ghazni province, which is a primarily Pashtun region, and where not a single Pashtun candidate won any seat. And there were numerous reports of violence and fraud. Ghazni province is one of the big provinces where a lot of Karzai supporters came from in the last elections.
Yeah. And then you wonder why Afghans tend to be very cynical about the democratic process and the whole government structure that the West is imposing on Afghanistan.
All right. Moving on, finally, a report this week out by the UN.
Yeah, the UN released their annual AIDS report, and there's some good news in there. 2009 saw a decline in new infections, about 20% fewer in 2009 than during the peak of the AIDS crisis in the late 90s. That's come mainly from improvements in Africa, particularly in South Africa, where a new president is much more Thabo Mbeki was in denial in terms of the AIDS crisis, and he didn't really believe that AIDS was a real disease. Well, now you have a new president in Joseph Zuma who not only acknowledges the AIDS crisis, he actually very publicly got tested for AIDS and is encouraging others to do the same. You know, he supports the use of condoms. AIDS drugs are more available to people in Africa in general, particularly to pregnant women who can take the AIDS drugs in order to keep from infecting their babies. That's been a very big positive in the whole fight against the AIDS epidemic. There's still a lot to be done, but it's been helpful to have a president in the United States who does not put unreasonable conditions on aid to AIDS groups in Africa and the rest of the developing world. And it's also been very helpful to have a pope come out and say that, yes, it is possible and it is okay for people to use condoms if they believe they might become infected with AIDS if they don't.
Yeah, you had, if you recall, a lot of positive press for the Bush administration, several years ago about all the money that the United States was giving toward combating AIDS. But that money came with conditions like, you know, they have to teach abstinence-only sex education, that sort of thing, which is simply unrealistic in any culture, but particularly in the African culture where you know, sex education doesn't really exist. It really has made a huge difference that a lot of that money coming from the United States now is being spent much less based on ideology and much more based on actually from a public health standpoint of what will be effective in preventing the disease.
Yeah. In addition, a lot of nations in Africa are starting to decriminalize homosexuality, which is allowing for the spread of safe sex education in all populations, not just in the heterosexual population.
All right. Moving on, events.
Yeah, this coming Thursday, December 2nd, it's December already, that is correct, 7:30 p.m., Chris Hedges will be in town talking about his latest book, The Death of the Liberal Class. That will be 7:30 at Town Hall, downtown Seattle, $5 at the door will be the ticket to get you in. And then as you heard at 7:30, the trial is coming up for the Disarm Now Plowshares. That'll be coming up on Tuesday, December 7th, and we'll give you all the details on that, the trial and some of the support events happening next week, so look forward to that.
All right, so people should show up in proper mourning gear for Chris Hedges' talk on the death of the liberal class.
Or awake might be appropriate too.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is the locally produced Eat the State website, which has local and national and international news and opinion and calendar items and all that kind of good stuff. Check it out. And if you have comments, questions, feedback, tips, drop us a line. Editorial@eatthestate.org is our email.